It's time for us to begin. If you would please turn your Bibles once again to Acts chapter 21. Acts chapter 21. We note that in Acts chapter 21, the Apostle Paul has come into the city of Jerusalem essentially for the last time. He is arrested in the city of Jerusalem. His efforts are to return as he concludes the third preaching journey to the city of Antioch. That has been his practice, Antioch of Syria, where he has been sent out on these three preaching tours, widening the circle a little bit in some variations each time. But this particular time, the third preaching tour, he has collected funds for the needy saints that are in Jerusalem, intending then to go to Jerusalem and be there for the Jewish feast day of Pentecost and to provide these funds for the needy among Christians that are in the city of Jerusalem. Now, we've talked about that extensively, I think, and seen not only from the writings here that that's his intention, but also from the writing of the apostle to those in Corinth and 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. As he is on his way to Corinth to collect those funds, and then from Romans 15, as he writes the book of Romans, having arrived in Corinth, and tells them, beginning in verse 25, that he's on his way to Jerusalem to distribute these funds that have been collected. So that sets the graph on the chart of where he is and why and so forth. But when he arrives in Jerusalem, he arrives with those funds for the needy saints that are in Jerusalem. Now, we emphasized in a couple of studies verse 17, because that's the beginning of his the notations of his arrival in the city of Jerusalem. And it tells us that when we came to Jerusalem, verse 17, the brethren received us gladly. We remarked about how an outstanding statement that is, because there was concern that these brethren who are of Jewish background might not want to receive any help at all from their brethren who are Gentile in background. And that's where Paul has been, up in Macedonia and Galatia, Macedonia and Achaia, among Gentile churches, collecting these funds. And he addresses that in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. That relationship of Jews and Gentiles. But the very fact that we see here in Luke's historical record that the brethren received us gladly, that was an answer to prayer, an answer to the prayer that he called upon the Romans to pray, that it might be received. And you can read that in Romans chapter 15, beginning in verse 25 through the next few verses. But then you'll note that in verse 18 now of our text, Acts chapter 21, it tells us, "And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. And when he had saluted them, he rehearsed one by one the things which God had wrought among the Gentiles through his ministry." Now, we made some comparisons between this arrival in Jerusalem and a previous arrival in Jerusalem in Acts chapter 15, where we've got an issue existent, Jews and Gentiles, all among believers, but Jews and Gentiles. Jews binding upon Gentiles who are becoming Christians that unless you receive circumcision after the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And I've asked you to a number of times to compare the dialogue here in Acts 21 to the dialogue in Acts 15. And I think you'll find that there are some rather interesting comparisons to be made between those two passages. In fact, some of the same things are referred to and noted here from that previous discussion. But what we want to note here is that they have rehearsed the work that they did among the Gentiles, like they did in Acts 15. And there was an occasion of rejoicing and glorifying God for the blessings that are now being bestowed upon those who are Gentiles. But we've got a problem. Here in Acts 21, much like the problem that we had in Acts 15, and that is these Judaizing teachers. If you'll note again in verse 20, it says, "And they, when they heard it, glorified God and said unto him, Thou seest, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of them that have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. And they have been informed concerning thee that thou teachest all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. What is it therefore? They will certainly hear that thou art come. And then in verse 23 is where I want to pick up some things we talked about last time. But again, to set the stage, here's these accusations. They're not unfamiliar to us. We've studied them before in Acts 15, where people who, well, the apostles were accused of teaching against Moses, teaching against the law, and teaching against circumcision. And none of that essentially was true. They were teaching them that the law is fulfilled and that if you're going to keep a part of the Old Testament law, then you're obligated to keep all of it. And we've noted the things that Paul had taught in a number of passages. 1 Corinthians 7, Galatians 5 and 6, and then in the Ephesian letter of Virgil, as we've been talking about that from Ephesians chapter 2, we've seen the things that Paul taught. He didn't teach any of that. And so these elders make this suggestion. These Jews that are in the city of Jerusalem, and we want to identify that this is one of the most important Jewish feast days. So we've got Jews from all over that have come. But the concern is Jews who are now believers, Jews who are Christians. You see, you can kind of push aside, I guess, some accusations of those who are steeped in Judaism as far as their religion and their tradition, their customs and all that is concerned. But these are Jews who have obeyed the gospel. These are Christians. And you'd like to think a little better of their thinking process, that this element of prejudice would be gone, that they would see that the gospel is for everybody, and that includes the Gentiles. And as we see, there has been occasion, at least among the leadership of the church in Jerusalem, to rejoice that the gospel has been preached among the Gentiles. And that was the message from Old Testament prophecy. We've already talked about all of that from as early as the promise made unto Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. That his seed would be a blessing to all families of the earth. That would include his descendants and others who were not, as far as Jews and Gentiles are concerned. But now here's the problem. Paul, they're going to hear that you're come into the city, and this is what they've heard about you, and so we want to dispel any kind of prejudice that might exist in their attitude toward you. So here's what we want you to do. Verse 23. We've got four men here that have a vow on them. And what we want you to do is to take these men and purify thyself, verse 24, with them and be at charges, that they may shave their heads, and all shall know that there's no truth in things whereof they have been informed concerning thee, but that thou thyself walkest orderly, keeping the law. Now that's just real interesting to me for a lot of reasons. We talked about the substance of that, I think, in some detail, perhaps sufficient detail, in our last study. And what we want to note from that is that these elders are not suggesting that Paul commit sin. They're not suggesting that he go back and just be a good Jew. What they are suggesting to him is that there are some things that are associated with the heritage of Judaism that are not wrong in and of themselves. And to the extent that you can, your conscience will allow, we would like you to participate in those things so that these people will simply see that the accusations that they've heard against you are not true. Now, isn't that simple? Now, I used an illustration last time that I'm going to reiterate just to illustrate this point. When you see something with your own eyes and you know this is the way that it is, and it conflicts with what you have previously believed, which one will you accept? If you just heard something and you believed it to be so, and now here are facts that are presented to you, which one will you believe? Well, you'd like to go with the facts, wouldn't you? Let me illustrate. Now, that might be a little bit difficult. It might very well be difficult. The illustration is this. When we look back at Jacob, and we talked about this in our Tuesday morning class, you remember when Jacob thought that Joseph was dead? He'd been led to believe that. Now, granted, those brothers of Joseph didn't tell him, Joseph is dead, but they presented evidence without conflicting it
trying to persuade their daddy that their brother was dead. Now, what did Jacob believe? Based upon that, he had accepted for a long, long time that Joseph is dead. For over 20 years, I believe about 22 years, he had believed the wrong thing. And then when his brothers finally came up out of the land of Egypt, having bought supplies and so forth, and they said, Joseph is alive, and he's right up there next to the king of Egypt. He's second in command of all of Egypt, and he's sent all these provisions and wagons and food and so forth and sustenance to bring us down to the land of Goshen, the richest land in the land of Egypt. What was Jacob's reaction? That's not true. That's just not true. Until he saw all of the evidence, and then he declared, my son is alive. Now, what I want us to see here is, if you've heard all these accusations against Paul, why he teaches you don't have anything to do with Moses, he teaches against all the customs of the Jews, and he's teaching us not to circumcise our children. And now here you see Paul coming out of the temple, having been in the temple for some time, participating with these men who had this vow upon them and paying for whatever offerings that was necessary for them to complete their vow. You see that. Are you just going to go on your merry way and say, Paul teaches against the customs of Moses and he teaches we ought not circumcise our children? Well, wait a minute. What have you just seen? What have you seen? You've seen him participate in the very thing you've heard that he's teaching against. Now, which one are you going to believe? What you've heard or what you've seen? Well, you'd like to think what you've seen. Now, sometimes we're not honest enough to do that. I told you about a story some time ago of a fellow that had been to my house and participated in Bible studies, and his wife had brought refreshments, and after the studies were over, we'd have all kinds of good time at the kitchen, eating and drinking coffee and all that kind of good stuff that we all enjoy doing, and lo and behold, he got upset and said that you folks don't believe in associating with each other. You guys don't believe in eating together. What? You've been told that, but what have you seen? What have you participated? Why, you've even been to my house. Now, which one do you believe? Now, that's just exactly what these folks need to see in Paul, that these accusations are not so. Why, he didn't do that at all. Now, what he did teach them is that you don't teach your children or you don't circumcise your children in order to save them. What he did teach is that you're not under obligation to keep the law of Moses in order to be saved, because if you keep a part of it, you've got to keep all of it. And the fact is, you don't do that. But here are some traditions or some customs that are associated with their past, their family religion for 1,500 years, that are not wrong in and of themselves. Now, can he participate in those things? That's what the elders are suggesting that he do, so that these folks will see that you're not doing the very thing that they've heard that you're doing. Now, can Paul do that? And it was pointed out last week that Paul did do that, and there's no evidence that he contradicted anything that he had ever taught, that he's not committing sin, that he's practicing simply something to dispel the theories that they've heard about him. Now, yes, Randy?
I'm still having a big problem with verse 24.
All right.
Because it seems to me that the elders in Jerusalem are trying to get him to convince them of something that's not true.
No, I don't believe they're trying to get him to convince them of something that's not true.
What's worth it?
Yeah.
You know, that they will all know, and they will all know that there's nothing that the things which they've been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. Well, he's not keeping the law, meaning he's not following the law of Moses anymore. It's been he's assembling on the first day of the week. They're still worshiping on Sabbath.
All right.
So he's not keeping the law, like, you know, in that sense. He's not offering animal sacrifices anymore. He's not going to the priests and with his, you know, offerings.
Yeah.
He's not keeping the law. But it says here, do this and they'll know that you're keeping the law.
All right, let's qualify that. You yourself qualified that. You said, in that sense. And that's right. That's the key to it. No, he's not offering animal sacrifices. He's not going into the temple to take advantage of what the priest may do in terms of atonement and all of that. So he's not doing any of that. In fact, he's taught against that.
But are there any things associated with the law that have become a part of their customs? And we had this discussion last week a little bit. Were there any things that were associated with the keeping of the law that were simply customs? You see, when we use that expression, keeping the law, we sometimes keep it like Paul used it, or use it like Paul used it in the Galatian letter. That to keep the law, if you practice circumcision, you've got to keep all of it. Well, now, why were they practicing circumcision? In order to be saved. Now, if you're going to keep the law in order to be saved, you've got to keep all of it. But are there any other things, aspects that might be associated with the law, either directly or indirectly, that one might observe as a Christian? Like, for example, not eating unclean meats. Now, could a Jew who had never eaten a pig decide, you know, I don't think I ever want to eat a pig?
Or he can decide not to eat pigs because it hurts his conscience.
He could do that, but why would it hurt his conscience?
Because he'd never done it.
Well, yes, and because he had not done it before for this reason. Now, you see, here's something that's associated with the law. Under the law, is he saying, well, I can't eat pigs because I'll be lost? I believe that's an unclean animal. And if I eat a pig, I'm eating an unclean animal. And Moses condemned that. Well, no. No, he needs to be taught. And we talked about that as well. Now, here you've got a fellow that's a Gentile. Same scenario. Paul deals with it in 1 Corinthians 8, 1 Corinthians 10, Romans 14. Yes, it does have an application. Here's a Gentile who has been used to eating meats that have been sacrificed to the idol. And so he has some reservations about eating these particular meats because they in his past have been associated with the idol. Now Paul makes this point very pointedly. He said, we know that the idol is nothing. But this fella, being used to eating this meat, now what's it do to him? It messes with his head. Now what's he to do? He said, I'll eat no meat from now on from forever if it caused my brother to offend. Now, here we're looking at something that one may or may not do. It may be associated with his former Jewish practices. It may be associated with his former Gentile practices. It's neither right nor wrong in and of itself. So you're right in your statement, but I think the confusion lies in using the statement, keeping the law, using that expression to mean the same thing everywhere it appears. And it does not. It clearly does not here. When they say, we want these folks to see that you're keeping the law. Well, is he keeping the law in order to be saved? Well, no. No. But to keep the law in order to be saved, that was bound before the cross. But it's not bound anymore, you see. So here are some things that may be associated with it. They're neither right or wrong in and of themselves. But it teaches these Jews that I can do that. And it doesn't violate my conscience. And it dispels your idea that I'm teaching something against Moses or against the law or against circumcision. Well, he wasn't doing that. And I think in our last study, we talked about him circumcising Timothy. Well, did he circumcise Timothy in order to be saved? Could it be said then that he was keeping the law when he circumcised Timothy?
I don't want to necessarily jump ahead, but it's in the same subject. Just a couple of verses later, when he's accused of bringing Greeks into the temple.
Right. Verse 29.
Was it against the law of Moses to bring Greeks?
Yes.
Right, but the law of Moses is no longer in effect. But it's not a sin to bring Greeks into the temple.
That's right. But you see, they didn't know that. And number one, their accusation was false. He had not done that.
Well, that's true. I'm just saying that they made an accusation as if, see, he sinned.
Yeah.
When in fact it wouldn't have been a sin if he did.
Well, that's true.
Well, that still wouldn't have been a sin.
No, it would not have been. It would have been had the law of Moses been in effect. But the problem was it was not. And see, here we are in a period of transition that they're having some difficulties with. Yeah, very much so. Now, on that point, let's back up and hook on where we were and go forward just a little bit to the passages that I really want to discuss with you in some detail. In verse 25, he said, but as touching the Gentile. Now, here's the application. But as touching the Gentiles that had believed, we wrote, giving judgment that they should keep themselves from things sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what is strangled and from fornication. Now that raises all kinds of questions. Wait a minute, who said this? As touching the Gentiles that believe, we wrote. Who was it that wrote that?
The elders of Jerusalem.
These men, right. These elders of the church in Jerusalem. And you can read that back in Acts chapter 15 where this issue has been raised, and that's why. excuse me, why I ask you to go back and make some comparisons between these two chapters. It's a fascinating study to see the comparison, the contrast, as it were, between these two chapters. Now, you'll note in chapter 15, verse 1, the subject is introduced in verse 1. And certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren. Now, we know from the previous verses, taught the brethren in Antioch, which was a church that was composed of Jews and Gentiles. Now, these men came down from Judea, that is, those who are Jews, who are Christians, and taught the brethren, saying, except you be circumcised after the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Now, that keys in on our point, you see. They're not just talking about something that might be established as a custom, you see. Now, when we look at the practice of circumcision, yes, it was commanded in the law. We talked about that last time, but it was incorporated as an identity element all the way back to Abraham, Genesis chapter 17. But, you see, these fellows are not saying that it's wrong or that you just shouldn't circumcise your children. They're talking about something relative to salvation. You've got to do this in order to be saved. Now, that's a whole other ball of wax when you're binding something for salvation.
So you have to be a Jew before you be a Christian.
That's what they're teaching. Now, that created an issue among Gentiles who had become Christians. You see, there's the issue. And so in verse 2 of chapter 15, it said, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension. I love the way that's worded. They didn't have any small dissension. What did they have? They had a big dissension. That's right. They had a big dissension and question. And the brethren appointed Paul and Barnabas and certain others to go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. Now, when they got there, you notice they rehearsed the things that had been done among the Gentiles, like we said over here in Acts 21. And it's a great day. They glorified God for the great things that have been done among the Gentiles. And much discussion is taking place on this matter. And if you'll indulge me just for a quick moment, I want to notice this beginning in verse 7. It says, and when there had been much questioning, Peter rose up and said unto them, brethren, ye know that a good while ago God made choice among you, that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe. Now, what's that take us back to? Peter said, God told me to go preach to the Gentiles. Well, who? Cornelius, yes. You can read all about that in Acts chapter 10 and Acts chapter 11. It created problems in the church in Jerusalem even at that time, because now Peter has associated with those folks who are Gentiles, and he's called on the carpet for it. And the text continues in verse 12. It says, and all the multitude kept silence, and they rehearsed or hearkened unto Barnabas and Paul, rehearsing what signs and wonders God had wrought among the Gentiles through them. So it's a great thing, you see. Peter said, look at what God did through me among the Gentiles. Paul and Barnabas said, well, you know, we perform miracles among the Gentiles. And then James spoke up and said, well, that's what Amos the prophet said, that the Gentiles should call on his name and be saved. And you can read that in verse 17, quotation from the Old Testament prophet there in Acts chapter 15. Now, I get a little excited about that, because that's history. And if you look at the text, you know, folks, and another little, just a little aside here. If you look carefully at the text, the question of whether or not to circumcise folks in order to save them, that's the issue. And God had already answered that question, already answered it. So if you've got a little note above this text in your Bible that says the Jerusalem Conference, do you have that in your Bible? Well, that's not inspired. Nobody put that there by inspiration of God. Some man came along, he read that, and he said, oh, look, that's what that is. That's the Jerusalem Conference. No, it wasn't. They didn't come together like folk would in a conference and decide something that's going to be legislated upon the brethren. What they did is they are discussing this matter with the apostles and elders there in Jerusalem to see what God, now listen, had already said on this subject. What had God already said? They're not making a decision about it. They're looking at truth that's already been revealed. Who told Peter to go to the household of Cornelius? Holy Spirit did. So we could answer that and say God did. Yeah. Yeah. Now these miracles that Barnabas and Paul are doing, how were they able to do that? By the Holy Spirit. So God made them able to do that. Now, what was the purpose of the miracle? To confirm that what they said was accurate. Now, when we think of accurate, we want to compare that sometimes in our minds to something that's inaccurate information. That's not necessarily the conclusion we want to draw. What we want to see is, not only was it accurate information, but it wasn't lacking. It was all the information that God had revealed on the subject. Now, if what they taught was lacking, would they have been able to perform miracles? Well, no. But what they taught was not only accurate, but it was complete. Now, have they said anything about circumcising Gentiles? Well, no. And yet they were able to perform miracles. What's the forced conclusion? All right, circumcision, not a part of the gospel. You don't preach to the Gentiles to receive circumcision. Isn't that simple? Now, if you look at verse 13, James joins in and says, here's what the prophet Amos said. He just plain old said it. Now, I like to look at this passage because I hear folks all the time saying, well, you folks who members of the Church of Christ, you just bind where the Bible doesn't bind and you teach things that the Bible doesn't teach. And all this whole system of Bible interpretation, that all originated with man. Now, word of truth to it, you say that the Bible teaches by direct statements, approved apostolic examples, and necessary inference, and you coin those expressions like that they are inspired expressions. Well, no, I don't believe they're inspired expressions at all. But here's a problem that existed in the church, and how did they resolve it?
They're not inspired expressions, but they're basic tenets of communication.
Well, they are. They're basic tenets. That's how we
explain. You explain to me how what you want done without either telling me directly, showing me how to do it, or showing me an approved example of how where somebody else has done it.
Well, that's how we communicate with each other.
You can't do that.
Yeah, yeah. But what we see is that's how God communicated His will on this subject. Peter said, God told me to go down here and preach to these Gentiles. He told me to do that. So you look at my example. That's what I did. I didn't teach them to be circumcised. And then Paul and Barnabas rehearsing the miracles and the signs and the thing that you take home from that, the necessary conclusion, is that what they taught was complete and accurate and it didn't include circumcision. And then you've got the quotation from the Old Testament text of Amos. Here's what God said about the Gentile. Nothing about circumcising them. So what's the conclusion? What conclusion did they draw? The correct one, yes, verse 19, it says, wherefore my judgment is that we trouble not them that from among the Gentiles turn to God, but that we write unto them. Now this is chapter 15, verse 20. But that we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols and from fornication and from what is strangled. Now that's Paul's right there. But why did these folks in Jerusalem send this letter to the church in Antioch and to these other Gentile brethren?
These four things that they informed them about are the stumbling blocks
that all right, that are associated with what?
Idolatry.
That's right. This is your background. This is Gentile background. So what you need to do to be a Christian is don't be an idolater. You can't practice these things that are associated with idolatry. You can't do that. But what about circumcision? Well, you don't have to do that either. You don't have to do that either. Now, there's a very important statement found in verse 24 contained in this letter. It says, for as much as we have heard that certain who went out from us have troubled you with words subverting your souls to whom we gave no commandment. I like the way it's worded in the King James translation. To whom we gave no such commandment. Now, had God said anything at all about circumcising Gentiles? No. No. And said a word about circumcising Gentiles. Now, question. Do you operate on the premise of God's silence and say, well, God didn't say not to, so we need to circumcise these Gentiles? No, no, that's not how God teaches. He teaches us by telling us what to do. Okay? And where this issue has arisen, there was no such commandment given to circumcise Gentiles. Now that's the letter, brethren, that's referred to here in Acts 21. You read it. It says in this verse 25 of Acts 21, but as touching the Gentiles that believe, we wrote, giving judgment that they should keep themselves from things sacrificed to idols, from blood and from what is strangled, and from fornication. That's just exactly what you read in the letter over there in Acts 15. That's what they said. So they're making reference to that. Now, how did Paul react to this instruction that these elders have given him? Verse 26. He did it. He did it. It says, then Paul took the men, and the next day purified himself with them, went into the temple, declaring the fulfillment of the days of purification, and the offering was offered for every one of them. He did it. Now, here's the question. What should these Christians who are from Jewish background, who are accusing Paul of all these things, what ought they do?
They need to repent.
They need to repent. That's right. Because what they've been accusing him of, not so. Well, what about these claims? They need to stop making them. That's part of it, of course. They need to stop making these claims. They're false. These are false claims. Now, what evidence have they seen so that they know that their accusations aren't founded? They've seen him participate in the very things they're accusing him of teaching against. Now, that would make him one of the biggest hypocrites to hit the country, wouldn't it? Now, why don't we believe evidence, brethren? Why don't we just accept the evidence? Or is it better just to accept the rumor? Become parties, keep spreading the rumor. You know, the expression, some of you have been involved in religious controversies or controversies generally for a lot of your lives. And I've often raised the question, why do some of my own brethren accuse me of teaching this or this or this or not teaching that when they know better? And I think the obvious answer to that is, if you don't have the truth, what else do you have? See, it's a whole lot easier, Randy, for me to try to attack you personally and discredit you personally than it is to answer your argument. Now, that's what they're doing to Paul. If you can't deal with the teaching, then you just attack the teacher. That's what you do. You discredit the teacher. Now, that's what they're attempting to do. And these elders say, well, we've got a plan here that will dispel that. If you'll do this, then everybody will see that these accusations are not so. Now, having said all of that, any questions or comment before I pick up on verse 27?
We've looked at the most of this already, so I'll pass on beyond that. Verse 27.
Yes, Noah.
Wouldn't it be safe to say that Paul tried to become like them?
Yes, sir.
In order to convert them?
Yes, sir. In fact, there's a passage you want to attach to that thought, and that's found in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, beginning in verse 20. Well, you could begin at verse 19. He said, "For though I was free from all men, I brought myself under bondage to all, that I might gain the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law, not being myself under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law." And Randy, I think that addresses the subject that you brought up a while ago. He said, "I became as under the law, not being under the law." In other words, he realized he didn't have to keep the law in order to be saved. But he became as under the law. Then verse 21, "To them that are without law." Now who's that?
Gentiles.
That's the Gentiles, and we want to read that carefully because he's not identifying a people that have never had law. Never has been anybody ever lived that was not under law. And we know that because we can read in Romans chapter 14, verse 15, that where there is no law, there is no transgression. So if you find somebody that's not under law, never has been under the law, then you keep your mouth shut. Don't ever mess him up. Because if you teach him anything, now he becomes a sinner. Well, you see, that's ludicrous. Never a man ever lived that wasn't under law. But Paul said, "To them that are without law," that is, they were without the law of Moses. They were Gentiles. He said, "as without law." And then he said, "not being without law to God, but under law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might gain the weak. I am become all things to all men, that I by all means may save, that I may by all means save some." Now we see that. That's your point, Noah. He became as these things. Now that doesn't mean that he was willing to sit on the bar stool with the fellow and bib and engage in the drinking process so he can convert the drunk over here. No, sir, can't do that. But he can become as these folks in things that are right and honorable and in and of themselves so that he can teach them. And I think that's an effective tool. We need to wrap our minds around that. I've sometimes said, and Jim, no offense intended in this point at all, but I've often said that when I lived in Arkansas, I had an opportunity to work with some people that believed erroneous doctrines, many erroneous doctrines, but some of them got to be real close fishing buddies. And it's surprising when you're sitting out on the lake or sitting out in the boat, you literally have a captive audience. Where's he going to go? And so you can have some pretty good discussions on some issues that we need to talk about. And did. And I think was effective. Some of those folks stopped believing the things that were wrong and started believing the things that were right. Jenny? I didn't become a fisherman, though. As you probably have observed.
I think that sometimes what we get hung up on with the Jewish nation specifically is that Judaism is both a religion and a nation.
Yes, yes.
And so when you're a Jew, that doesn't necessarily mean you are practicing Judaism,
right.
But you could be. That's your nationality, but not necessarily your religion. And so when Paul is in Jerusalem and there are things that are part of Judaism that don't conflict with Christianity, he needs to, if he chooses to perform those things, he needs to do them according to how it's been prescribed in Judaism. So
right.
He couldn't say that, well, I'm just going to do this vow this way because I wanted to do it this way. If he's performing a vow that's prescribed in Judaism, he needs to follow the prescription in Judaism. And so that's, I think, what's being referred to in the vow here where it says, well, you keep the law. It's not that he's keeping the law in that way. It's that if he chooses to participate in this, he's doing it according to the prescribed.
Do it right. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Excellent. Any other thought or comment? Yeah. Carolyn?
Part of what he's doing is just cross-cultural respect. And today, if you travel anywhere, you know, you read some little thing that says, oh, be sure to, you know, follow this custom, you know, take your shoes off when you go in the house, or, you know, wear this type of clothing, or things that don't matter one way or the other. It just shows that you respect that culture, and then they don't have some kind of stumbling block against you because you did this thing that to them is shocking.
Excellent. Yeah, and those of you, I have not done this, but those of you who travel abroad, you realize that. And I'm told by folks who are, in particular gospel preachers that have traveled in other parts of the world, that you best be aware of some of those things. You need to be trained about some of those things so you don't just deliberately step on somebody. And you don't want to do that. That's foolish. Okay? Very good. All right, well, let's pick up this thought in verse 27, and another thought is introduced as far as their criticisms are concerned. It says, and when the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the multitude and laid hands on him, crying out, men of Israel, help! This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people and the law and this place. And moreover, he brought Greeks also into the temple and hath defiled this holy place. It never ends, does it? It just never ends. And so that's what we have here. This is nothing more than just a restatement of what these elders have said that these fellows are going to say about you. Now, you'll note that these are Jews from Asia. Now, we mentioned that this is a feast day. The day of Pentecost is when Paul has planned his travel to be there on these important feast days. So we've got Jews that have traveled from other places to be here. And we noted in Acts 15 that it appeared to be the locals in Jerusalem that was creating the problem. And now we have Jews that are locals joined by Jews who are from abroad that are creating this problem. And these Jews from Asia, they're very pointed. They say, hey, this is a fellow. Teaches all men everywhere. Well, that's not so. Teaches all men everywhere against the law. That just simply is not so. But if you'll turn in your Bible, again, this is not new. We saw in Acts chapter 6, these are essentially the same accusations that were brought against Stephen. And what they do with him? They stoned him to death, yes. And then you'll see further evidence of that in Acts chapter 7. And then we've already seen it here in Acts chapter 21 in verse 21. But I want to call your attention to verse 18 of Acts 24. Acts 24, verse 18. Now, if James were here, I would ask him to give us the sequence of discussions from these chapters, chapter 21, 22, and on forth, so forth through chapter 26. But in Acts 24, Randy Bowles, who is he talking to?
One say it was Felix.
All right, it was. And we note beginning in verse 18, just on the beginning of that preface of that argument to Felix, in verse 18 it says, amidst which they found me purified in the temple with no crowd, nor yet with tumult, but there were certain Jews from Asia who ought to have been here before thee and to make accusation if they had aught against me. Now, hear Paul in this defense. He makes fair mention of these very Jews that we're reading about here in Acts 21. And if they want to pursue this, they ought to be here to accuse me. Bring forth the evidence. Bring my accusers. But of course, they're not there, and they're not going to be there, and that just lengthens the stay of Paul in prison. But this additional charge, moreover, he brought, now this is back at Acts 21, verse 28. Moreover, he brought Greeks also into the temple and hath defiled this holy place, for they had seen or before seen with him in the city Trophimus the Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. Now, got a question for you. Would it have been possible for them to know whether or not Paul brought Trophimus into the temple? Could they know that? Yeah, you might do a little inquiry, maybe ask the question first, you see, but they didn't do that. It says, whom they supposed. Now, they'd seen Trophimus the Ephesian with Paul in the city of Jerusalem, but now hang on to this point. When Paul has traveled up here in Macedonia and come down to Achaia, and has left Achaia and come back, and now he's in the city of Jerusalem, what, was Trophimus the only Greek that was with him? Well, no. There were a bunch of folks with him that were of Greek background. We know some of their names. We don't know all their names, but we know some of their names. But now, hey, if you just happen to see a Greek in the city of Jerusalem with Paul, does that warrant the conclusion that Paul took this Greek into the temple?
No, I was just thinking, verse 17, we rather receive us gladly.
Yes.
That includes, I'm assuming that includes all the Gentile Christians that were with Paul.
Yes.
So they were welcomed to the church.
Yes.
Now the Jews that are believers there in verse 20, those Jews who have believed.
Yes.
Those are not the same Jews that are down in verse 28 when the Jews from Asia say, "Men of Israel, come to our aid." This is a man who preaches against to all men everywhere against our people. These are non-believing Jews.
Don't know that for sure. I don't know how you'd establish that for sure.
The Jews from Asia are there because of the day of Pentecost, right?
This is true.
They didn't come because they're Christians and they want to worship the church of Jerusalem.
This is true. But still, you've got Jewish traditions and so forth that might have brought them to the city of Jerusalem. Paul was there.
Because their family's still there.
It's possible. So I don't know that I could say that with absolute certainty. We might suppose that, but and it might be a good conclusion to draw, but I don't know that I could be definite of that.
Well, I can allow that if we don't know with absolute certainty, but I'm 99% certain what Randy's saying is true.
Well, it's possible. It's possible.
But I admit that it's not 100% clear. But in my mind, because I think you're being very generous to these Jews from Asia.
I won't be later.
Because I think they're flat making this up.
Yeah, well, like I say, I won't be later.
They see Paul coming out of the temple, and they're going to say, "Hey, we know he was with a Jew or a Gentile earlier. We're going to say he's had a... We might not know where he is right now, but we're going to incite the crowd up.
Yeah.
Do something."
Well, they did that, and I have the question, and we'll ask it a number of times between here and the end of the book of Acts. Who's running the country? These Jews, it seems, have time to follow Paul around from here to here to here to here to here and to create all kinds of problems. Don't they have a family? Don't they have a job? Don't they have something to do besides create problems for Paul? I think that's a legitimate question, but regarding these accusations, we know that these Jews who were brethren, Jews who were believers, have made exactly these accusations with the exception of Trophimus. Now that has been added. And so to say that the identity of the people has completely changed, I don't know that I could say that with concrete certainty. I just don't know that I could say that. But this additional charge has been given. We see that Trophimus has been with Paul and he brought him into the temple. Supposed, verse 29. Now, I tell you what, have you ever been accused of something that's false and then you've had the opportunity to confront the person that accused you and the response was, well, it seemed to me. You heard that? Does that sound familiar? Well, it seemed to me. Well, these folks had supposed that Trophimus, a Gentile, had been with Paul in the temple. It seemed to me like it. But no, that wasn't the case. He had not done that. And so we'll have to pick up with that, I guess, next time. I want you to identify clearly this chief captain that's in verse 31. We're going to have great occasion between now and the close of this book to talk about that man. And what was his name, Jenny?
Claudius
Lysias. Yes, Claudius Lysias. So we'll talk about him quite a lot between now and the end of the book.